might think that a walk from Kansas City to Montana would give you all the alone time you could possibly want. But when Patrick Dobson walked to Montana, he found plenty of distractions. People driving up alongside him, offering rides and places to crash. Then there were the towns to hang out in along the way. The trip home by canoe was another story. For a portion of the journey, he went 10 days without speaking to a fellow human being. Can you imagine 10 whole days alone on the water? I'm Gina Kaufman, here about Patrick Dobson's solo journey across the Great Plains, plus the story of a song with Madison Ward and Mama Bear. That's coming up on Central Standard after this news.
You think you can see the stars in Kansas City, but you really can't. Once you're out in the middle of nowhere on the Missouri River, the sky is just this huge, gorgeous palette of stars.
That was Scott Mansker talking to us last summer about paddling down the mighty Mo. When was the last time you saw the stars from the Missouri River? When was the last time you saw anything from the Missouri River? Turns out it's a body of water you can actually use to get somewhere. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we're talking to Patrick Dobson. He canoed the Missouri River all the way from Montana to Kansas City. His new book, Canoeing the Great Plains, tells that story. Hi, Patrick.
Good morning, Gina.
So did you ever stargaze on the water?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I was up in Montana, of course, it is like the reader said before, the person that you interviewed before, where you get a full palette of stars. You get to see the actual veils of the Milky Way. You get closer in and are closer to where it's really heavily populated, and you get to see this phenomenon of the light bubble, where the cities and the towns actually have like a glow to them against the sky.
And it looks like a bubble?
I think it looks like a bubble. It's sort of diffuse, right? There's a concentration of light that goes out and diffuses over a distance. But it is kind of a pretty thing. It makes the river seem very human.
The Missouri River actually has kind of a bad reputation, wouldn't you say?
Well, I have to say that when I first wanted to try doing this thing, I was in Kansas City, obviously, trying to figure out how I was going to get to the river and what I was going to do once I got there after my walk across the Great Plains. And I would call these people, canoeing club people and canoeing store people, and they only had this bad news about the Missouri River, this terrible news about whirlpools and big giant catfish and dangerous waves and all of these dangerous currents. When I was a kid growing up, my dad used to read headlines out of the newspaper. He was a Coast Guardsman, and he worked at the reserve unit that at that time was in Leavenworth. And then he was very interested in the Missouri River, but he would read these headlines about people getting squished under barges and drownings down at the old Riverfront Park in Kansas City. And so it was kind of scary to me and it's got this bad reputation, but I found a much different river, of course, than what I'd always been told of.
Well, if you've ever traveled along the Missouri River, call in with your own experiences. We're hearing Patrick's story today, but we want to hear yours too. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. That number again is 816-235-2888. Patrick, we should probably back up and start from the beginning. In your previous book, Seldom Seen, you wrote about walking all the way from Kansas City to Helena, Montana. The canoeing trip, which you write about in your current book, is like part two of that story. It's the journey home. So let's backtrack to the long walk. You had some personal demons you were fighting back then.
Yes, I was I left on the trip because life had gotten real routine, and I was afraid. I was really scared that my life was just going to be that routine of getting up in the morning and going to a job that I had sort of gotten old in. You know, I have a shelf life at real jobs of about 6 months. And after
dangerous
that...
Dangerous thing to confess on the radio.
Yeah. And then after that, things get rough. The only job that I ever had that I lasted longer than 3 years at was when I was working for the Pitch back in the 90s. And I would have stayed there had the Pitch not been sold to another company. But So I was afraid. I was really scared. I was a father. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know how to be a dad. I just wanted life.
You were a pretty new father?
My daughter was 4 when I took off, or almost 4 when I took off across the Great Plains. And I wasn't leaving her, but I really wanted to show her and myself that life could be different, that it didn't have to be the things that we'd always been told it had to be.
And you had some other demons in your past that you write about in both books that seem to factor into this. I mean, it doesn't seem like you were leaving to escape or wrestle those demons, but the process of warding them off seemed to be part of the decision to go.
Well, yeah, I had some very difficult times when I was growing up, and of course, when I was a young adult, I don't remember much of the 80s, frankly, and so I was trying to come to terms with, you know, getting cleaned up and trying to live a legitimate life, and I didn't know how to do that really. And again, walking across the Great Plains was a great time of contemplation. It was a time when I could actually think some things through, and try to figure out what daily life might be when I got back, and hopefully it was going to be different. It wasn't going to be routine. It wasn't going to be the same kind of low self-esteem and lack of confidence that I left with. And I found, of course, that doesn't, you know, just because you take a walk, it doesn't change everything.
You're still you even when you're walking.
Right. And it doesn't change everything in your life when you get back either. I found out that life is really a process, that it's not something that stops at one moment and begins at the next moment. Just because I walked across the Great Plains didn't mean I was going to become a stellar father and a great worker and a fantastic sort of writer. It didn't mean any of that at all. It meant that I was sitting back at home now contemplating, wow, how do I really change these things, and that these changes were going to come over time, not overnight.
Did anything about the journey itself teach you how to change, if not making it didn't make the changes for you, but did it give you any lessons that were useful and
sure.
How to do that?
Sure. You know, I'm not what I consider to be a very smart guy, and so I basically learned a lot from other people that I met along the way, how they were living their lives, how they were adapting to their routines, how they sort of determined how their lives were going to be. And realizing that, you know, some of them were trapped by their pasts and their childhoods and the things that they grew up with and the influences that they had. And, you know, seeing that and becoming aware of it in my own life was a very important step in trying to do something different when I came home.
How long did it take you to walk from Kansas City to Montana?
It took 2.5 months. And I did take rides along the way, but there were people always offered them. I only hitchhiked once. That was outside of Lecompton, Kansas, on a very narrow road during a rainstorm. And I wanted to get out of it. It was very dangerous, I felt. And so I hitchhiked for 6 miles. I went took a ride for 6 miles.
To get out of that path.
To get out of that path.
Obscured vision.
Right.
Well,
and so then when I took rides, I'd only take it for what would be, say, a day's walk. And then otherwise, I could have gotten to Helena, Montana in 2 days if I'd have stuck my thumb out. And
yeah.
That wasn't going to be very fun.
What surprised you most about the experience of walking?
I kind of felt that walking would give me a different perception of space and the Great Plains, because I've always been fascinated with the Great Plains. Family vacations when I was growing up, when I was I went to grad school in Laramie, Wyoming, and made that trip across Nebraska and Kansas something like 23 times in 2 years because I had a baby in Kansas City. And it's fascinating stuff, and it's beautiful once you're there, but man, when you're in the middle of it and you're all by yourself, I really got a notion of my significance in the universe, which is really insignificant, because you're so small in all that big space.
Was that unsettling, or did you experience it as a positive?
For me, it was positive. You know, being humbled like that actually helped in this process of changing the everyday world that I lived in, because I became, I think, less selfish. Not that I'm saintly or anything, but I realized that, say, being a dad is not always about being perfect, but just trying from day to day to do something right.
For someone else.
Right, exactly.
In your recap of this journey at the start of your new book, you write that the things people warned you about before you left said more about what they feared than about the dangers you would actually face. Can you explain that a little more?
Sure. You know, I got to tell you, before I left, the biggest question or the most frequent question I got from people was if I was going to take a gun. And my response to that, it took me a while to formulate a response, but I responded that I wanted to meet people. I didn't want to shoot them. But can you repeat that question? Can I get that again? I got lost. Well, the gun thing sort of took me out of
it. This idea that people warned you about things, people were sure that you were going to encounter all kinds of dangers, and their certainty reflected more about them than it did about what your true experience was once you got out there.
Right. And when they told me that I should fear crazy people, malevolent strangers, wildlife, getting hit by cars and so on, those were things that they were afraid of. And those are reasons why they would not have taken the walk. And I realized this after getting these repeated questions over and over again and seeing some patterns in them. And then understanding once I got on the road and began going through this process of getting a routine, getting up in the morning, walking every day, that none of that stuff, that's stuff that you imagine when you're sitting at home in the living room, those aren't things that are really out there.
If this new book were a movie, there's a passage that would be like a montage-style flashback to your walk from here to Montana. I'd love for you to read that for us now. Do you know the passage I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. Thank you very much. Let me start here. Two nights running, bears sniffed me up while I lay frozen in my lean-to. I had a cold and the flu and suffered innumerable foot problems and several pairs of bad shoes, and once a swarm of biting flies bloodied me. None of it had turned me around and sent me home. Most of the way, in fact, the weather had been good for walking and animals had been gentle. I had met hundreds of people, many of them open, funny, or generous, or all three. A convenience store clerk in Beatrice, Nebraska, asked where I was from when I walked into her shop. Assuming I needed a place to stay, she tossed me the keys to her house. No questions. Just outside of North Platte, after I went through a number of lightning strikes near the ground, a spunky kid with a blue streak in his hair plucked me out of the rain. Through the ringing in my ears, I listened as he told me how much he wanted to be a musician. His future, he said, had to be better than the life he knew. A middle-aged corporate manager from Riverton, Wyoming, explained how he feared for his future, his career, and his personal relationships. When he dropped me off at a lonely lake on the Wind River Indian Reservation, he thanked me for letting him take me there. In Yellowstone, a couple from Boston gave me a ride in an RV big enough to house a family. While he drove, she padded around in fuzzy pink slippers and showed me postcards of all the wonderful place they had visited. What came next for me, she said, was sure to be nice.
I love that. Right after that, you tell your readers what you learned from it all. Could you read that one just last short paragraph?
Sure. These people had shown me that I make my own misery. When I left Kansas City, I dreaded a rainstorm when it wasn't raining. I feared creatures when they weren't around. I worried where to stay. I feared homicidal maniacs, robbers, and just plain mean people. What I imagined was always worse than real rainstorms, animals, crappy camping places, or people.
Central Standard is headed to a short break. We'll get right back to our conversation with Patrick Dobson about his walk to Montana and now the solo canoe trip back home along the Missouri River. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to Central Standard. We're talking this morning with Patrick Dobson. Before the break, we heard about the really long walk he took from Kansas City to Montana. That was back in 1995. Now let's hear about the trip home by canoe. He's written about it in a book from the University of Nebraska Press, and you can share your stories about the Missouri River too at 816-235-2888. Patrick, when did you get the idea to come home along the Missouri River?
Well, I tell you what, it was an accident. My girlfriend's son, when I told him what I wanted to do, and he was only like 6 years old, he said to me, well, once you get to Montana, you can do the Lewis and Clark thing and come home. And after he said that, and after that idea was in my head, it became something that I had to do. And I'll tell you real quick that a lot of my life is motivated by fear. And I was scared to even think about walking across the Great Plains, much less come back on a river that I had no idea about.
And that one's scarier, the canoeing scarier?
Well, all of it was scary. But there came a time when I began to fear not doing it more than I feared doing it.
And what was scary about not doing it?
There's always that thought that if I don't do it now, I'll never do it. And that's a real motivator for me. And it's motivated a lot of the things that I've done in my life. If I don't do this now, then that's an opportunity that's slipped away. Now, of course, none of that's true, right? I mean, you always have the opportunity to do these things. But there's that feeling in the moment and that anxiety that it builds in me that really makes me then take off on a new direction or do something that I've always wanted to do and never had the courage to do.
Do I understand correctly that you did not have very much canoeing experience?
A drunk weekend, several years before I got into my canoe on the Missouri River was all the canoeing experience that I had. And like I said, I don't remember much of the 80s, so I think I passed out on Friday afternoon and came to at home on Sunday and have no idea what happened in between that time.
So, I mean, what is your sense now of what the dangers you faced were at that time as an inexperienced canoer taking on the challenge you were taking on?
Oh, you know, I've never really thought about that. If I look back and consider the kinds of things I was getting myself into, I have to say, Gina, that I'd do it again. There were some things that I took on that probably would have hurt me. But I'm the kind of person that I guess I look at those sort of dangers and think, well, you know, if this is the things that life presents me, then that's what it is.
But what are, would you say, the objective dangers of
I see.
Canoeing the Missouri River for a long way? By yourself.
Mostly heat and insects. Those are the things that I think are the most dangerous, or at least they were to me. When I first started out, I was really scared of these big rapids on the Missouri River, and really they were no more than rough patches of river. When I got into the big lakes, that's when things really got. It wasn't scary so much, but not making any progress from day to day. I'd spent 1 week going a little more than a mile on Fort Peck Lake.
There's a kind of brawny guy who's a character in this book, and I don't remember his name, but he gives you a lesson early on. You like meet someone who's like, oh, you've got to talk to this guy. He'll tell you everything you need. And he makes a pretty strong case for all sorts of really dangerous things that could happen to you.
You know, Gina, I'm lost.
Oh, the guy who you referred to him as the perfect specimen.
Yes, the perfect physical specimen. Thanks for reminding me. His name was Reg, and I took my one canoe lesson in Helena, Montana from him on a tiny park lake that was no more than a pond, and he was instructing me, and I was doing very badly at all this stuff, and he told me about things that, like sweepers, which are trees that have fallen in the water. And you don't want to get involved with the sweeper. You don't want to get out of the water in case of this or that. He had a number of other things.
Yeah, you've got to hang on to the boat if you get tossed out because it'll keep you afloat.
It'll keep you afloat, and you can swim your craft. This is what his quote was. You can swim your craft to the shore.
Your craft.
And it turned out after all of this, I mean, this guy was huge, and he was blonde, and he was everything a Teutonic Aryan guy would look like. And then I asked him if he'd ever been on the Missouri River, and he went, oh, no, it's too dangerous. You know, and he was a whitewater canoer and rafter, and it just stunned me that here I was trying to take this lesson and learn these great things from a dude who'd never been out there.
Well, and you made it back alive. That's a good testament. We do have some other callers who have their own stories about canoeing the Missouri River at 816-235-2888. Let's hear from Mike in Lee Summit.
Hello?
Hi, Mike.
Hi there.
Hi, Mike.
Hi there. I'm loving the show so far. I'm an avid canoeist, and I canoe the Missouri River regularly. Matter of fact, every year I participate in the Race to the Dome.
Oh,
it's
great.
It's about a 25-mile race. I recommend it to people. What can I say about canoeing on the Missouri River? I kind of hate to dissuade people from the horror stories because it keeps the river real quiet. It's a beautiful place to canoe.
Isn't it one of those places that does have its dangers, and there are things you need to be concerned about, but none of them are as big as people make them out to be.
And most of the dangers are when they come up are about half a mile down the river from you, and you can definitely steer around them.
Right.
Mike, what do you like about...
Side dams and barges are your biggest problem. That's about it.
And there's not even many of them, frankly.
No. Very little traffic, very little commercial traffic, and very little sports and pleasure boats.
Right. Well, around Kansas City, anyway, there are places like St. Joseph, Nebraska City, the Sioux Cities, where people really do use the river a lot. But around Kansas City, not so much.
No, and not much happening all the way down to St. Louis.
Right.
Mike, what is the appeal in getting out on the river for you, other than that there aren't other people there?
Well, it's beautiful. It's quiet in a canoe. You can hear everything. You can see everything. The river is just absolutely gorgeous.
It is
so big that when you get on it, even though you've got a 6-mile current, you feel like you're on a lake.
And the river is moving around, or the world is moving around you rather than you moving down through the world.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. You'll meet interesting people along the side. People have little fishing docks out into the river, and the culture along the river is just delightful.
Well, thanks so much, Mike. You know, Patrick, I am curious about the people you met on the river.
Well, they were there. It was different than walking, because in walking, you're always around people. When you're on the river, or when I was on the river, there were these long stretches where there were no people. But the people that I met were very interesting, very generous, very open. I'll never forget a woman I met in Williston, North Dakota. I was just sitting on a park bench near, their downtown, and this woman came up. She was dressed 1970s polyester with a big bouffant and horn-rimmed glasses, and she just started talking to me and chatting me up, and I shouldn't say chat up in the sexual sense, but she just started talking, and I asked her, "Well, what are you asking me this stuff for?" I mean, in a nice way. And she says, "Well, people don't ever sit on these park benches." And I said, "Well, you're sitting on them." And she says, "Well, I never talk to people on these park benches." So she just had to have this conversation with me, and there were other people too who were very generous, and they helped me along the way. One guy, as a matter of fact, took me around these big, huge reservoirs, which make up most of the Missouri River between Williston and Yankton, South Dakota. Really, my canoe was very light, my gear was very light, and I had no experience. And just the thought of spending 6 months or 8 months trying to canoe those lakes really devastated me. And some guy in Williston decides to take me the 750 miles down to Yankton. And it was, how do you express
As in he canoed alongside you?
No, he took me took my boat on the top of his truck and drove me down there. And it really was an amazing sort of gesture of generosity. And all he wanted was gas money, All he wanted was gas money.
You know, you've mentioned your equipment a little bit. Tell us a little bit more about the basics, the specifics of your plan, the provisions you had with you, that kind of thing.
Well, specifics of my plan, I'm not sure I ever have a plan, frankly. But I basically, in my boat, I talked to a canoe maker in Limerick, Maine, who sent me a prototype of a boat that they wanted to make for all they wanted was a telephone call to tell them about that boat. So they sent it to Helena, Montana. And in Helena, I put my backpacking equipment, and I had another dry bag full of food that I thought I'd need. And that was my all of my equipment. I had a tent sent to me because I had been hiking without a tent. I had just a little lean-to that I'd put up. But because of the bugs on the river, I actually got a real tent. And that was all of my equipment. The whole, my boat, me, all of my equipment, everything weighed only about 350 pounds.
That actually sounds like a lot to me.
Well, it sounds like a lot, but when you're in a 30 mile an hour wind in front of you, that's really not that much. I met a guy in Omaha, and his rig weighed about 700 pounds with all the stuff that he had in it, and he was more well provisioned than me, and had anticipated a whole lot more loneliness than he actually found out there.
So. Tell me about your first day on the water, because that must have been a real experience.
Well, my first day on the water, I was really frightened. I actually stayed two extra days at the riverfront access near Wolf Creek, Montana. And when I finally got out on the water, after the first 5 miles, I thought, hey, this is easy stuff. This is fantastic. And I'm going to be an expert in no time. And then I ran into my first rapid, and it looked really scary. It looked like big stair steps in the river with standing waves and so on. And I sort of looked and found a little chute over to the side, and I thought I'd walk my boat down the chute, and found that the river was rougher there than in the middle of the big stream.
Let's turn. We have a few callers, and I'd like to get to Sam in Westport. Sam, what have you got for us?
Thanks for taking my call. I recently purchased a guidebook on the Missouri River, and I was curious. I haven't read it yet. How easy is it to get supplies, like food and things like that, if you're going to be canoeing along the Missouri? And where's the best place, like you recommend, if you're going to do like a week-long trip to start and end?
Well, I tell you what, there's all different places that you can get in on the river, and there's all different kinds of country because the river flows through such varied geography and topography. I like the stretch between Kansas City and St. Louis for a week trip. You can get it done in a day. I mean, people do that with the big river race that they do. But I like to take my time, and you can get in on a lot of sort of little riverfront parks. Places like Chemois, Missouri, Washington, Missouri, Herman, Missouri, Waverly, Miami. There's all kinds of places to get out. And in some of those places, walking up to a grocery store is really no problem. My rule was always to have at least 2 or 3 days of food with me, just in case I didn't run into a place that had a lot of provisions for me.
You know, speaking of towns along the river, I read Mark Twain's Life on the Mississippi that was written a very long time ago, and the Mississippi and Missouri, maybe not the same thing, but he writes in that book that the river actually kind of changes its path all the time. Like the current of the river changes the land, and then that changes the path of the river and so on, and that keeps happening. So the river might go up to a certain town one day and not on another day. Is that true? Is that...
Well, it was true. All of the Missouri River that, say, Sam might get on between Three Forks, Montana, and St. Louis is really a human construct because it's dammed shortly before it begins. It goes through three dams before it gets to Helena, Montana. Then there's Fort Peck Lake and these other huge reservoirs for 750 miles along the river. And then once you get past Ponca State Park in Nebraska, the river bank is revetted. That is, there's rocks along the river, on the riverbank that hold the bank in place. There are wing dikes all through the river that keep the river in a particular channel. So it doesn't move around like it used to. And in a way, that's kind of sad. In another way, however, it can make some access easier for some people. And
navigation, I imagine.
Well, navigation's actually very easy on the lower river because the Corps of Engineers has some navigation books that you can get online that have places marked on them, like riverfront parks, industrial facilities, takeouts, and so on and so on. But, the river as... you know, no matter how much human beings have fiddled with the river and keep fiddling with it, there's still something, it hasn't lost its riverness, if I can say it that way. And that's what I think our previous caller was talking about, in the sense that it is a really beautiful place. And if you canoe through the middle of a place like Kansas City, you see life there. You see cars. You see trucks going over bridges. You see the buildings. But you feel like you're 1,000 miles away, because it just doesn't feel like anybody's looking.
You talked earlier about long stretches of time where you didn't see other people. What's the longest you went?
I went about 10 days without seeing without seeing anybody else. And really, it kind of drove me crazy. I didn't realize just how much human interaction really influences my thought processes. And so after a few
days... Or interrupts them.
Well, yeah, or interrupts them, that's right. It keeps me from looking inside. So on the one hand, the solitude was really fantastic. On the other hand, it was really disconcerting. After a few days, I quit talking to myself. My thoughts began to spin in tighter and tighter circles. Little frustrations that maybe weren't frustrations 2 days before would send me into a rage. And then you come back when you're with people, and it's really weird how you have to really, I anyway, had to learn again how to modulate my voice and to keep from cackling and talking too loud. And
to be a social person.
I'm not sure I forgot. It's just that without that influence, without that daily interaction with human beings, those were sort of temporarily gone.
Did you gain anything from that experience? Anything that you felt on the plus side?
I loved it. I can't tell you how much I loved being alone, because it wasn't lonely. It wasn't like, you know, I longed for human companionship. There were times when I did, and that's when I got lonely. But being alone and being with the river and being with the woods and whatever really, and there's something about the cadence of canoeing and the way the water sounds against the boat and the way that the paddle bangs against the side of the boat from time to time that really is very comforting, and you never get bored. I mean, when I got bored, it was because I was stuck on a rock someplace in the wind. That's when I got bored, and that was when I began to get lonely.
So now, the whole time this is going on, you've got a daughter back home, which we were talking about earlier. She was 4 at the time?
She was 4. I came up, I cooked up the trip when she was 3, and I worked very hard for the next year, all the overtime I could, to make enough money to save up to go on the trip and keep my rent paid while I was gone. And I talked to her when I was on the walking trip. I talked to her as often as I could. And there's always a payphone at that time. We don't have very many payphones these days. And then a phone in somebody's house. On the way home, I would be able to call her from Riverfront Parks. But generally, that was after I got to Yankton. Talking to her and thinking about her, you know, I really wanted to be a good dad. I won't say that my dad was a bad dad. He was just a kid when he was having babies, and he didn't have a chance to mature, I think. And I wanted to be different for my daughter. And ultimately, I think it was. I mean, I did go through that whole thing that dads and moms go through where they really don't know what they're doing. And it really frightened me at the beginning. So I wanted to show her that life could be different, that people who come from the working class like we had didn't have to follow a particular path in life, and that life really could be whatever you wanted to make it. And maybe that was my thought behind leaving her for 5 months, was to try to figure out how to show her how things were going to be different.
And you and your daughter's mom were separated, so she was with her mom, but how did she understand why you were going? Do you know how she felt about it?
She was very upset when I decided to do it, but again, you know, this is one of those things that when you decide you're going to do it, you have to be courageous about it. And I felt very selfish from time to, I shouldn't say from time to time, for I felt guilty and selfish almost all the time. But once I got the idea, once it became a thing that I had to do, I had to make the decision not to let anything stand in my way, including myself.
Yeah, it sounds like the decision to not let this new ambition or new idea wither and fade into regret was really important to you. I mean, that maybe partly because of your own history, it was important to you.
Well, yeah, and not to let it fade into regret, I think that's a wonderful way to put it. And it comes back to that fear, if I don't do it now, then I'll never do it. And regardless of whether that's true or not, that for me is a real powerful motivator. You know, I was going on 30. I think I was 31, 31, 32 when I did this. And then since then, I've gone on and been on the river many, many, many times. I've gone from Kansas City to St. Louis, done long stretches of the river here in the Midwest over and over again. And every time I still get that feeling of, you know, you've got to get this in. Life is only so long. I've got to get this in. And there's also a little spirit of adventure in there, too.
A few different times when you're out on the water, you write about moments of triumph and, like, survival after a really rough patch. And you mentioned in these passages that you're yelling and shouting in celebration. Is that something that just happens like an animal instinct? Because sitting in front of you now, you do not seem like a hooter and hollerer.
Well, I have to say that part of it is from this animal instinct, and part of it is there's nobody around. There's nobody to be embarrassed in front of. There's nobody who's going to hear me. And so there's this ultimate feeling of freedom that I can just express myself actually however I wanted to. I mean, there's going to be cows. There's not going to be a lot of people around.
Central Standard's off to one last break. If you have questions for Patrick Dobson, author of Canoeing the Great Plains, we'll try to get some of those in at 235-2888. That's the 816 area code. We'll do that when we return, plus a visit with the mother-son musical duo, Madison Ward and the Mama Bear. That's coming up on Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Patrick Dobson. He's the author of Canoeing the Great Plains, A Missouri River Summer, and he'll be presenting on that book on May 7th at the Plaza Library at 6:30 p.m. You can get all those details online as well. But Patrick, what did you learn about the river itself on your journey?
Well, you know, the river to me growing up was always something that just flowed under the Broadway Bridge through something that looked like a trough. What I've found out is that the river has a personality, sort of a consistent personality, from the upper, the High Plains and the Rockies where it begins, all the way through to the Midwest. But it shows that personality in various ways as it runs through these various geographies and topographies, different ways in which the plant life changes from one place. And, you know, there's like these gradual changes that happen as you move down the river from really the semi-arid west and through the High Plains to really the verdant Midwest. And it really, it's its own entity. It almost, there were times when I began to think, well, maybe this river thinks, you know, maybe not like a person, but it sure has its own life.
Can you describe one of those moments that made you think that?
When, for instance, when I was in this terrible rain and thunderstorm near Cascade, Montana, the river seemed to be very indifferent to anything that I was going. It really felt like some sort of biblical encounter between nature and human. But as soon as the storm stopped, I realized that the river was carrying me all the way through, that all that fighting and all that worry that I'd put into it and all the fear, I probably would have made it just fine without any of that. And the river just really seemed to be this sort of constant. And I don't know how to describe it other than it has its own sort of riverness.
Let's hear from John in Kansas City North, who has a question for you.
Oh,
hi,
great.
John.
Hey, Pat, how's it going?
Good, very good, John.
Hey, how far up north do you have to get on that river before the water's, like, clean enough that you feel like you can get it and cool off or something if you got hot?
Well, that's a great question, John. You know, I was really fearful of I love swimming. I swim a lot at the pool, and I still swim in the river from time to time. But I have this phobia about water that I can't see the bottom, you know, or water that's very deep. So I was very unadventurous when I swam in the river up north. And, of course, up north it's very, very cold, and after it goes through those dams it gets even colder. But down here in the Midwest, say after Yankton, South Dakota, it's fat and warm. And, you know, let me answer this question this way. When I first got on the Missouri River ever, it was in 1991, and the river really did have a dirtiness about it. You could see a lot of litter, things that hadn't sunk, you know. So you had this, I had this notion that, you know, I'm just seeing the tip of the iceberg.
Because yeah, there's shoes a lot all the of way stuff down.
That, yeah. And the river is so much cleaner these days than it was even over the last 20 years. And certainly from the time that in the 1950s when it really was just a sludge pit. I'm not going to say you can drink the water at Kansas City right out of the river, but I don't have any compunction about taking a dip in it, cooling off.
Patrick, I have some friends who probably unwisely, like, dunked one another in the Missouri River one evening, and I encountered them later, and the smell was, like, nearly intolerable.
Well, it's the same smell that you get in a pond, because there's a lot of sort of stuff that dies in the river and floats to the bottom, and then you stir that muck up and you stir up the methane and the stuff that goes with it. It's the same thing that you would get, say, swimming in a pond and that muck at the bottom of a pond, if anybody's ever swam in a pond or a lake. But just taking a dip and not stirring up the muck, it's not so bad.
And you think that ecologically that water's on the upswing?
Well, it is now. There are movements afoot to rein in the EPA, and if it hadn't been for environmental law changes from the 1970s through to today, including tightening standards on wastewater treatment, the river would not be in the condition it is today. But there are these movements afoot to relax regulations, and really I don't think that bodes well for water quality in the Missouri River.
Tell me about the final days of your journey. Were you at all sad that it was coming
yes.
to an end?
Yes, yes. It was. I wanted to get out. I wanted to see my daughter again. There were certain aspects of home that I thought would be comfortable, but I kept wanting the river to be longer. I didn't want to get off. Especially after Omaha. I met a guy in Omaha. We canoed together to Kansas City, and we really lived like a couple of Huck Finns. I mean, except to go into a town to get something to eat, we didn't put on our shoes for 2 weeks. Sometimes we stayed on sandbars 2 days running just because we felt like it. There was big bonfires. There was, you know, but so there's all of this stuff going on. And I don't want to go home anymore. I mean, I kind of looked forward to going home, I guess, at the very beginning. I felt like I was, when I started the river trip, that this was the start of moving back home. But as the river began to take me forward, I kept hoping and wishing in those final days that the river was just longer. I wanted more miles between me and Kansas City.
There's another character in the book, and maybe it's the one that you're describing now, who says to you, you can't go home again, not because it's a strange place, but because you've become a stranger.
I think that was my friend Don Brown, who I...
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, who I... he's a friend of mine from Laramie. He was a friend of mine. He's been gone now for several years. But coincidentally, me and this John character who I met in Omaha pulled into Nebraska City, and I saw Don's van there. And he was working on a highway project when they were building Highway 2 into a four-lane highway from Nebraska City to Lincoln. He was driving a cement truck, and it was just this sort of real coincidental, wonderful meeting between two old pals in a real coincidental thing.
But this idea that it's not home that becomes strange, but you who've become a stranger, is that what you've experienced getting back?
I've experienced that on time and time again. When I was younger, I went to live in Germany and came back after working for a year in the vineyards on this trip on the way home, and several other times when I've gone away, come back to the same thing, and I'm very different because of the travel.
What are you doing now? The short version.
The short version is I'm living the life I've always wanted to live. I get up in the morning, drink a cup of coffee, and then write most of the day. So,
Patrick Dobson, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Gina.
Patrick's book is called Canoeing the Great Plains, A Missouri River Summer. He'll be talking about it May 7th at the Plaza Library. And now we hear from a Kansas City band that seemed to come from out of nowhere in the past year. 26-year-old Madison Ward and his mother, Ruth, are from Independence. They've been performing together in coffee houses for 5 years or so. Madison says they weren't trying to make a statement as a mother-son duo.
We weren't trying to be, you know, overly different or overly unique. We both played with other musicians off and on, and every time that we kind of came back to playing with each other, it was when it started to sound the most, you know, electric. I just told my mom, I was like, do you want to just stick together?
They officially became Madison Ward and the Mama Bear 2 years ago, and they've gotten a lot of national attention in the past year, signing on to a label, getting a nod from Rolling Stone, and performing around the country, including an appearance on Letterman. For this story of a song, Madison Ward, with input from his mom, tells us how he wrote the song Silent Movies.
I don't usually have a particular, you know, message that I'm trying to convey. It's usually just trying to capture emotion. I'll just kind of hunker down into, you know, my apartment and just try to, you know, shut everything out. And it's really about, like, kind of solitude and, you know, isolation and just trying to shut everything away. It's the music first. I don't usually write and then build a melody around what I wrote. I love just coming up with a melody. I think most of our music, I think, is just very melody driven.
How about we just sing forever? Bring your pains close together, baby.
I had just finished watching the film The Artist. The silent film, The Artist. And so I went home and I started writing a song.
Silent movies make more money, so help them make more money, girl.
And the word silent movies kind of came out organically as I was just humming this melody that I was making. And then so I started just kind of developing the song about not really always communicating with our voices and just kind of relying on music.
My role comes in as we are playing the song. I might add a little bit of this, or we might take out that, or whatever. And he's basically the songwriter, but I add, you know, my little two cents every now and then.
And texture,
yeah, very texture. That means he'll play the song, and if I feel like it needs a certain guitar riff or sound on the guitar, I produce that. If I feel like it needs a little harmony or sing along with him or some places in the song, I will do that. It just comes natural. Like he says all the time, it's organic.
Silent movies make more money, so help out, we make more money, girl. So help out. When you dance, they call you funny. So help me, we get real funny, girl. So what, girl?
I try not to, whenever it comes to writing, pick out anything that's so specific that other people can't really relate to it in a way. So I try to keep it to where it's timeless, if I can say that. I try not to be too metaphorical. I might be fictional, but I don't like to be too metaphorical. You know, if you look at silent film back in the day, there was no talking. There was just, you know, the classical track being played over all the images. So that's kind of like what that's about, is just let's get away from, let's stop talking for a second and just play some music or listen to some music.
That was Madison Ward and the Mama Bear. They told the story of their song, Silent Movies. It's on the album Skeleton Crew, coming out next month. Madison and Ruth talked to our producer, Sylvia Maria Gross. You can catch the band live this weekend at Mills Record Company, and again next week at the Middle of the Map Fest. All the information is on our website, kcur.org. To revisit our conversation about canoeing the Missouri River, go to kcur.org/centralstandard. Sign up for our podcast while you're there, and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Tomorrow, we're talking unusual Kansas City desserts with our food critics. Central Standard's produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's it for today.